note bloat, alert fatigue, clinician burnout. Can recent guidelines from the Department of Health and Human Services reduce these problems? Sometimes help comes in the most unlikely of places. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief and the co-author of the new textbook, Prescribing Psychotropics.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Last February, the Department of Health and Human Services unleashed one of the first major overhauls to their billing and documentation guidelines in several decades. And today, we're going to show you how to make those new guidelines work for you and your patients. And while we do that, we're going to trace a little history back to the dawn of the medical record. But first, a preview of the CME test you can take to earn credits for this episode. The physician who developed the first medical record in America is better known for taking care of which founding father on his deathbed? A. Benjamin Franklin, B. Benjamin Rush, C. George Washington, or D. Alexander Hamilton?
25 years ago, the Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, released the Evaluation and Management, or E&M code, 99212, 99213, 99214, and 99215, each representing an increased level of complexity and reimbursement. The idea was to reward clinicians for doing more complex work. But like a lot of good ideas, it backfired. The E&M scorecard calculated complexity in large part by how many signs and symptoms you assessed and how many words you wrote in the EMR. In response, clinicians started packing their notes with cut-and-pasted text, spilling over with endless symptoms checklists that had nothing to do with the patient's problem.
Even as a patient, I noticed, all of a sudden my dermatologist started checking my blood pressure. It's part of our insurance requirements, the nurse told me.
Soon it was the medical record that had a disease, and the disease had a name, note bloat. Clinicians were no longer able to find the information they needed to help the patient in these rambling notes. Many lost trust in the accuracy of what they were reading. Errors spread through EMRs like a virus as they were cut and pasted from one specialty to the next. And to generate this Tower of Babel, the clinicians turned their back to the patient, their faces fixed to the blue light of the computer monitor. Many of you have lived through this, and some of you may have noticed a disturbing trend. As EMRs spread in the past decade, bringing with them the technology to supersize the medical note, so did the number of talks and articles on clinician burnout. And that is no coincidence. Research from the Mayo Clinic has directly linked burnout to these ungainly EMRs. Here's a quote from their 2020 study. The usability of current EHR systems received a grade of F by physician users, and a strong dose-response relationship between EHR usability and the odds of burnout was observed.
For a while, psychiatry was relatively immune to all this, as the code we used for medication management, 90862, didn't have many documentation requirements. But in 2013, DHHS put 90862 out to pasture, replacing it with the 9921 E&M codes that required us to document a lengthier symptom checklist. In 2013 was a rough transition. It practically turned us all into bean counters as we tried to tally our notes with this unwieldy bullet system that DHHS devised for other medical specialties, and we had to figure out how to apply it to our own.
So when DHHS rolled out the first major overhaul of the E&M documentation requirements last year, we weren't too excited. And when we read the Byzantine guidelines on how to pick a billing code, we wanted to crawl back into our psychopharm textbooks and keep our Carlette reporting to more clinical topics. We found two points of light in that labyrinth to inspire you. One, the new guidelines reward clinicians for what they do, not what they write. Two, they reward providers for taking on complex patients rather than writing complex notes.
Like the old billing guidelines, the new ones have a point system. But instead of rewarding points for each symptom you document, the points are rewarded based on the more complex and time-consuming tasks that you do to help patients. Do you ever get the family's perspective on a patient with mania or psychosis? That counts. Do you ever coordinate care with the primary care doctor? Add a point. Do you ever draw labs, read hospital records, review neuropsychological testing, or go out of your way to help patients who have major psychosocial barriers to health, like they can't afford their medications? Well, if you do that, you're on your way to a high score. And if you don't want to tally up all these points at all, there's another option built into the system. The new guidelines allow you to bill purely on time. And that's pretty simple. You just document how much time you spent. They even let you include the time you spend writing the notes and doing other administrative tasks related to the care, like reviewing labs. In this podcast, I'm going to try to simplify the other half of the billing guidelines with the point system. And to make it fun, we'll gamify it a bit. So the guidelines have three categories, each with four levels of complexity. The higher the level, the greater your score, the higher your reimbursement. But if you fail in one category and still score high in the other two, you still win, because your final score is based on the highest level achieved in two out of three categories. So let's get into those categories. They are 1. The number and complexity of problems or diagnoses. 2. The number of extra steps you took in gathering information. That's where all the interviews with family members, coordination with PCPs, and review of hospital records and labs comes in. And category 3 is the overall risk of the treatments and the patient's condition. Is the patient suicidal? Do they need extra support to keep them out of the hospital? Are you monitoring a high-risk medication like lithium or clozapine? Any of those will move you up into the gold star status, the highest level of complexity in this category.
Three categories, each with four levels, and each level has 2 to 4 bullets that let you earn points. It's a pretty complicated board game. And like most DHHS initiatives, it wasn't written with psychiatry in mind. So we've translated it for psychiatric use in the paper journal. For example, in DHHS speak, there's a difference between a lab and a test. A lab is a simple blood draw, but a test is more complex, involving more specialized skills to interpret, and usually has its own billing code to run it, like a sleep study, neuropsych testing, an MRI or EEG of the brain. Another important distinction is in the word stable. We use that all the time in psychiatry to describe patients who are still functionally impaired by chronic, unchanging symptoms, but who aren't in an active episode of, say, psychosis, depression, or mania. Well, you should stop doing that, because in DHHS speak, stable means full remission, and this matters, because the new system is going to pay at a higher rate if your patient has active symptoms, even if they are chronic and unchanging, what we used to call stable, than if they are in full remission.
At first sight, a lot of these changes seem annoying and unnecessary, but look carefully, there is a good reason behind most of them. Take stable. DHHS doesn't want us to just ignore patients' problems because they seem chronic and unchanging. They want to wake us up and incentivize us to start treating and taking care of these real problems, even if they've been going on a long time. In the end, what it all boils down to is whether you're going to bill 99212, 99213, 99214, or the high-scoring 99215. But to gamify it a bit more, with high stakes come high risks. And if you do bill too much 99215, you're setting yourself up for an audit. Insurers compare your billing patterns to those of your psychiatric colleagues, and if you are an outlier, they may decide to audit you. But don't let that scare you. If you, say, run a clozapine clinic, you should probably bill more 99215s. Years ago, I attended a workshop on the old CPT codes that was aimed at general medical providers, and they suggested that billing more than 10% as 99215 could trigger an audit. But we have no idea what the real number is, and those were different times. And for a psychiatrist, you know, in the old system, it was almost impossible for a psychiatrist to bill 99215 because to do so, you'd have to do cognitive tests and check blood pressure and temperature along with dozens of other symptoms and then justify the medical necessity of doing so. I mean, maybe for delirium that could qualify, but in the new system, a psychiatrist could reach the 99215 level just by managing a severe rash on lamotrigine or working out a safety plan with a suicidal patient to avoid hospitalization.
And that is what is most inspiring about all this. I don't want to offend any listeners, but it's hard to be politic about this. Doctors, including psychiatrists, have a long history of avoiding seriously ill patients. Some refuse to accept hospital discharges. Others don't treat schizophrenia. A scathing article from 2014 in JAMA Psych found that only about half of U.S. psychiatrists accept insurance, compared to about 90% in other specialties. And treating private pay patients is a sure way to limit your practice to the higher functioning set.
When I was in training, one attending shared a story about his private practice days that left a bad taste in my mouth. He said he screened out low-functioning patients by making his office difficult to find. Later, I read a book on the business of psychiatric practice that detailed the various ways that, quote, comfort-seeking middle-aged psychiatrists seek to avoid treating patients with borderline personality disorder. Now, in fairness, sometimes all of these maneuverings are done out of sincere belief that complex patients are better managed in a group practice. Perhaps one that has a DBT program or an ACT team for schizophrenia. But we can't ignore the financial incentives that have long been in place for doctors of all types to take care of the worried well.
And thanks to DHHS, we can now say those days are over. People with overdoses, hospitalizations, suicide attempts, and frequent psychosis should no longer have to search far and wide to find a clinician to take care of them, because reimbursements are going to be much higher for those patients than they are for primary insomnia or generalized anxiety disorder.
And you no longer have to write 5-page notes to get that kind of reimbursement. The new system is very simple. At its core, all you need to do is document a problem list. The more problems you are treating, and the more severe, chronic, or complex they are, the higher the points.
The rest of the note is up to you. It's still expected that you'll document according to professional standards in your field, but DHHS no longer wants to be in the business of dictating what those standards are for all professionals. And that makes sense. The old system, which required the same level of documentation for a psychiatrist as an ophthalmologist, wasn't very realistic.
Now, we're going to boil the system down to its simplest form, but we recommend you do look online at our article so you can fully personalize it to what's going on in your practice. And here's a simple way to use it that'll work for most psychiatric clinicians. Now, remember, you only need a high score in 2 out of 3 categories. In one of those categories, the risk category, the way they define it, simply prescribing a medication brings you to a level 4 out of 5. That's 99214. You don't need to change the med, and if the patient doesn't accept your recommendation and doesn't even take the medicine, you can still bill at the same level. So if you recommend an antipsychotic and the patient declines, you'll still get there. So, okay. Most of your visits, you're going to get 1 out of 3 of the categories automatically. So all you need is one more. The next category is the data. But honestly, we usually skip over that one because unless you're ordering labs, reading hospital records, talking with the family, and consulting with the PCP, and you need a lot of points, you're not going to get a high score with this category. And frankly, if you have to do all that stuff, you're probably already dealing with a complex, risky case, and you've probably already reached a high score in the other categories. So let's move on to the third category, which is the problem list. Here's how it works. If the patient has at least one chronic disorder with active symptoms, or at least two chronic disorders in full remission, you've made it to level 4 here as well. So you've made it all the way to 99214. Now, what is this word chronic? Well, the way they define it, chronic is based on the disorder, not necessarily the patient. So let's say a patient who is in their first episode of mania, they have a chronic disorder because bipolar is a chronic disorder, even though they're in their first episode. The bottom line is that most psychiatric disorders are considered chronic, including ADHD. We've listed a few in the online issue that are not chronic. So, if your patient has, say, bipolar disorder and panic disorder, not an unusual combination, you've made it to level 4 in this category. Even if both are in full remission, or as DHHS put it, stable. And here's another tip. DHHS considers any active side effects the same way it considers active symptoms. So let's say your patient only has bipolar disorder and they're fully stable, but they're having, say, a lot of polyuria or tremor on the lithium. Well, that would count as an active symptom.
Bipolar disorder actually has a higher rate of comorbidities than other conditions, including panic, PTSD, ADHD, addictions, eating disorders, personality disorders, and OCD. We featured a few articles recently on managing these comorbidities, like a two-part series last fall on bipolar and ADHD. And in this month's report, there's a new study on treating bipolar with OCD.
These new guidelines are part of a long history of trying to find some meaningful use in medical records. That history dates back to their origins in the early 1800s, when U.S. physicians first began keeping regular notes on their patients. The movement of using a medical record was driven by doctors, and the goal was not to fend off malpractice suits or bill insurers. No, the first medical notes were developed just for research and teaching. Doctors figured that if they gathered all their patient histories together, they might see trends that could guide future medical innovations. These notes were shared with students, and they were often kept in the lobby of the hospital for relatives of patients to see. Privacy was not as much of a concern back then. And the physician who started it all also has a cameo role in a popular Broadway play.
How does a bastard, orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
On August 17, 1804, a New York physician sat down to document the case of a 49-year-old man who had died a month earlier from a gunshot wound. The patient, Alexander Hamilton, was the creator of the U.S. financial system, and his doctor, 35-year-old David Hozak, was about to create the country's first medical record. Dr. Hozak believed that if physicians recorded the details of their cases, they could amass a collection of medical data that would be useful to students and researchers. He proposed this to the Board of New York Hospital in 1805, and so began the medical record. It wasn't until the 1890s that malpractice attorneys started asking for medical records, giving doctors yet another reason to document their work. By the 1960s, the medical record had become bloated with labs, tests, orders, and consultation notes, and doctors were having a hard time finding the information they needed in the unwieldy three-ring binders. That's when Larry Reed developed the problem-oriented note, a simple solution that gained widespread attention after he published it in a 1968 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Reed called on physicians to organize all their treatments and data around problems so that each note ended with a numerical list of symptoms or disorders they were attending to in their patients' care. He died in 2017 at the age of 93, but he would have been pleased to see DHHS return to his problem-oriented system. Breed was no bean counter. He was a creative and dynamic physician who drew inspiration from the far reaches of art and philosophy as he put together this new method of medical documentation. And here is Reed speaking at medical grand rounds at Emory University in 1971.
All right, now let me make one closing remark about what this has all got to do with the art of medicine. Where is the art of medicine going to go with all this? If you have lists and numbers, well, art is style, structure, form, discipline. It's Andrew Wyeth making Jamie Wyeth do the painting 50 times until it's right. Unbelievable discipline about technique. He made that boy tear up a painting 100 times. It's George Zell, if you've ever watched him with that orchestra. The same passage, 30 times until it was perfect. And no violinist stood up and said, this is interfering with my art. Nor did Bach say, 3 beats in every measure? Oh, that interferes with my creativity. That's too like an old maid. No. Art is Hemingway 3 weeks on a single paragraph. It's Bach recording in detail everything he did a couple hundred years ago so we can hear it today. It's not a scribble in the middle of the night. It's not saying, I took good care of her, leaving absolutely no trail for us to ever find out whether you did or did not. We debase the word art itself when we call what we've been doing art. And it's not science. So we have to be extremely careful when we defend what we're doing. We don't reveal to others that we didn't even get out of a liberal arts education. As Stravinsky says, that art is nothing more than placing limits and working against them rigorously. And if you refuse to place them and try to work within them, but just flail out, you do not have art, you have chaos. And to a large extent, that's what we've had. Thank you very much.
Note, bloat, burnout. We promised this podcast would help with those and with a third. And that's our word of the day, alert fatigue.
Alert fatigue describes how clinicians become desensitized to safety alerts. The most common example is drug interaction alerts in electronic medical records. Studies have found that clinicians override nearly all of these, including the ones labeled critical. The longer they use the system, the more likely they are to ignore them. And the fact that most of the alerts put out by these systems are inconsequential only compounds the issue. We have a solution. Doctors Aiken, Bader, and Carlett spent the last 3 years researching drug interactions to boil it down to the ones you really need to pay attention to. It's all in their new book, Prescribing Psychotropics, From Drug Interactions to Genetics. The book doesn't just tell you if an interaction exists. It tells you what to do about it. Here's an example. Let's say you're adding an antipsychotic to carbamazepine for bipolar mania. Your drug interaction software says that carbamazepine may lower that antipsychotic, but by how much? Turn to page 121 and you'll see what to do. If it's risperidone, you'll need to raise the antipsychotic 2 to 3-fold just to adjust for the carbamazepine interaction. If it's a aripiprazole, you should raise it even more, 3 to 5-fold. And if it's quetiapine, you probably shouldn't use it at all because that interaction is going to create an active metabolite, norquetiapine. That has antidepressant qualities and can worsen mania. Since I've started using it, I look forward to those interaction alerts. I know when to ignore them and when they can help me fine-tune the dose to better suit my patient.
Start earning CME credits for this podcast through the link in the show notes. You'll help us stay free from pharmaceutical support so we can keep bringing you unbiased information you can trust.